The purpose of these role plays, in which we are involved during these three tapes, is, of course, fundamentally to help apply to concrete situations some of the things that we've been talking about in the previous tapes. Now, I want to make a suggestion to you. As you listen to this tape, and the tape which follows, it might be very interesting for you simply to turn off your tape following the role play itself, the presentation of the material in its dramatic form. Then, as an individual or as a group, whatever the situation in which you're listening, you might discuss or think through the problem. You might turn to the actual case as it's given in the case book and look over the questions on the right-hand page that are appended to the case and see if you can answer those and if they stimulate other questions in your thinking. Then, having gone through it yourself, you might turn on the tape and see what other people have said about it. I think you would find this very useful. Indeed, you might even gather together a group or two of other people from time to time and play some of these cases and get their discussion of it, and then let them hear the discussion that follows on the tape itself. So these are just a couple of how-to suggestions for you. Now comes our next presentation.
This is case number 9, page 140 in the case book. And we have expanded slightly on the circumstances to make the situation a little bit more interesting and to allow us to interject some more problems that we feel are common. Harry was a dedicated military man and an active layman who always put his career first, church activities second, and whatever time was left, which was very little, went to his family. He rationalized that he was doing what was best for his family by being successful in his career, bringing them up in the church, and giving them the material things and security that he felt they needed. His first marriage ended in divorce, and he married Viola, considerably younger, but also a divorcee. Both of them brought problems into the second marriage and were overly defensive and sensitive regarding their first failures. Harry and Viola came for counseling 4 weeks ago because communication had virtually ceased. We now look in on the beginning of the third session.
You've done a fine job on this assignment, Harry. I can see you have done some real soul searching. There are just a couple of things I want to clear up, though. You have listed your three problems as being overbearing, impatient with your children, and lack of incentive. Do you see any relationship in these?
It may be that they all point to selfishness on my part. I guess that I'm impatient because the kids prevent me from spending my evenings relaxing. And possibly my lack of incentive only manifests itself when the task is for others, and I'm very demanding because, I'm just too lazy to do things myself.
I think you've hit it right on the head, Harry. And your second answer might just be the solution. Love is the opposite of selfishness. It is nothing more than thinking of the needs of others and then living to meet them. For next week, I'd like you to read 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and write it out in your own words and see if there aren't some things there that you can learn about your relationship with Viola. Now, Viola, let's take a look at your findings. You believe you are easily frustrated, overly sensitive, and that you find difficulty in trusting in Harry's decisions. Is there a common factor here, too?
Well, wait a minute. What's this about...
Wait a minute. Don't I get to say something?
Folks.
Yes, me.
Just a moment.
Okay.
Let her finish, and then if you have something to say, we'll get to that. Okay?
Now, what did you ask me?
Well, what I asked you was, and you've listed three problems, and I just wanted to know if you saw a common factor in them. Is there something that all three can be related to one particular problem?
Well, I suppose that they're all related to Harry. And the reason that they're all related to Harry has a tendency of getting these big plans, and he just goes off on his own way. He doesn't even consult me and ask me what I think about it. He just does what he wants to do. And I look at things differently than Harry does. He just doesn't realize this. And he doesn't consider the details of it. How are we going to pay for this? He just goes off and does it. And I find it hard to trust his thinking because he's made so many goofs in the past. Every one of these has always been wrong. And if he'd listened to me and I could tell him what he's supposed to do, then we wouldn't have all these problems.
I see. I see.
I think I'm listening to you quite a bit.
Come on now, folks. Remember, we had an agreement now. We weren't going to bicker back and forth. Each one of us would take turns and we'd talk these things over. Let me answer her, Harry, and then if you don't think I do an adequate job in responding to this problem, then you can perhaps add a little at the end.
For sure, I'll just be right there.
All right, fine. Let me say, first of all, that you two are really making my job a lot easier. You've done a lot of inward looking and come up with some real sound things here that we can take a look at now and maybe find the solution to. I believe it is possible that your three problems can also be summed up with one solution. God has ordained that the husband is to be held responsible for the actions of his family. He tells us Eve was deceived, but Adam sinned. The principle behind this is woven throughout the scriptures. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul tells the man to have a sacrificial love for the wife and the women to be in subjection to their husbands. It is God who commanded the woman to trust the man's decisions because God himself is in the process of conforming both of you to his son's image. If you think of Harry as an instrument with which God is working on you, I think you will see that the decisions he makes are really part of God's plan for both of you. Did you have anything else that you'd like to add to that, Harry, or did that pretty much...
Well, I think that's right. My decisions are straight from God, and I think she ought to listen to me.
No. That's not exactly what I said, Harry. Let me clear that up. Harry, there seems to be a little misunderstanding. First of all, I didn't say that the things that you decide are God's perfect will. I said that God uses them in his plan to conform you to the image of Christ, both of you. And so you are going to continue to make mistakes, as she pointed out that you have in the past, and I'm sure that you will continue to. But what Viola needs to remember is that these mistakes are being used by God to make her the type of woman he wants her to be, and you the kind of dependent man upon God he wants you to be. See, if we all only succeeded in everything we did, then we would be pretty self-confident, and we wouldn't really need to turn to the Word. We wouldn't need to turn to God and find out His solutions. So I don't really think everything you say to her is God's command. I would just say that God uses it, and let's try to leave it at that. Is that okay? Okay. All right, well, let me see here. Viola, for next week, I'd like you to read and write out Ephesians chapter 5, which tells you your relationship to your husband, his relationship to Christ, and then maybe you can understand more clearly what I was trying to explain here in the session, and I'll see you both of you then.
Thank you very much. These actors are really very true to life. I've heard just that kind of thing happen in counseling sessions very frequently. I think maybe they know what they're talking about. Now, let's look, however, at our counselor. He is a very amiable person as he comes across here, very gentle. He's in charge of things in general, and he's trying to stop the wrong kinds of things from happening, and all that's good. We want to give him lots and lots of encouragement along those lines, but we've got to stop and say, whoa. He has fallen into the trap of every novice counselor. Every trainee we have has difficulty at first with the problem that he is having trouble with here. So it's a very common problem. But it's a very vital one, and that's exactly why this case was put in here. Everything on these lists on page 140, in way of problems and solutions that both Harry and Viola have brought to their counselor, is so abstract that they simply cannot be dealt with. And this counselor was willing to settle for counseling in abstractions. Now, if you put the questions to the first column of problems, what specifically do you do that is overbearing? And get some concrete particulars, then your list begins to blossom with things you can work with. If you ask, you're quick to anger at the children usually, all right? About what sorts of things do you get angry, children? Over what issues do you find your temper flaring up? Get those down. We can then work with concrete particulars again. What do you find that you have a lack of incentive in doing? About what do you need more incentive? And then Viola. Over what do you find that you are frustrated? Sure, but over what sorts of things? Then we can go to work on item 1, 2, 3, and 4 that's listed under there. But we can't go to work on frustration. That's just an abstraction. You'll be very frustrated over working on frustration. You're very sensitive about what? Your hair? Your looks? Your weight? What is it, Viola, that you're sensitive about? You override your husband's decisions in everything, or are there certain areas or particular kinds of sensitive circumstances? And then with the solutions, if you put both the what and the how questions to the solutions, you'll find that you'll begin to see them sprout all sorts of things that you can get handles on. Ask rather than demand and not expect others to fetch and carry. What? About what, you see? Do all things in love. Well, now, that's very nice, but how are you going to do all these things in love for those children particularly with reference to those particular things that you are quickly angered over? And with reference to an incentive, you're going to get up and do a thing when you think of it. That's fine, but let's get some items scheduled, not just when you think of it. Let's get some scheduled right now that you can start working on. After all, you may not think of it for the next 6 years. And ask the Lord for patience. Of course, you should ask the Lord for patience. But about what? And what are you going to do beyond praying about it? How are you going to get that patience? And then look at the matter from his viewpoint. Fine. How are you going to go about doing that? And then be more submissive. What does that mean concretely? Where can you start being submissive tonight? You see. In what ways can we do this? So look out for generalizing. That's the key. Get concrete, specific. Get into the what and the how. Get down to the how too. And then you're cooking. Okay, we're going to now turn to their next case. Or this is an entirely different group now that's coming to fill in the picture, and I suppose we'll hear from the group we've heard from at a later point again. All right, these new players are coming up now, and they're about ready to introduce their case.
This is case number 9 from the case book on page 18. And again, we have amplified the circumstances. Vic had a previous marriage that ended in divorce because of infidelity concerning both partners. Marie had been divorced from a man who didn't want responsibility and had abandoned her and the 3 children. Vic had received custody of the 2 children from his marriage, and when he and Marie decided to marry, they combined families. Vic and Marie were having marriage problems as well as serious problems with their children. They sought counseling, and now we look in on their first session.
After hearing all of these problems, I agree with you, Vic. This is a very complicated problem.
Right. Putting together 2 messed up lives like Marie's and mine has really made it kind of a wild household, and we just haven't been able to figure it out.
Yeah, I can see how that would get so frustrating, with, you know, all the children and the various personalities and all, and
It just must be a problem for you. Now, before you leave, I'd like to know one more thing. You were mentioning that your son disagrees and often has problems in relating to Bill, who's Marie's 16-year-old, and that they're about the same age. Now, can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I know from what you've said, you have discipline problems there, how to control these children, and I know that this will be a source of irritation in your family. Maybe you can tell me some of the things that they disagree about.
Well, they fight about everything. Who's better in football? Who gets better grades in school?
Mm-hmm.
Who dates the prettiest girl?
They're
just at it all the time.
Well, do you think that just because they're so close in the same age and there's somebody in the family, do you think this might just be a situation where they feel competitive toward each other?
I'm sure that's it.
Mm-hmm. I think probably that is. Well, I tell you, we'll keep these things all in mind. I think we're beginning now to just get a picture, a true picture of what is going on in the family, and I understand the situation a lot better than when we started. And I tell you, we'll be thinking about these during the week, and then let's get together again next week, and I think we can begin moving out in this area.
Thank you. Now, they, of course, just simply, in a very fine way, went through the case as it was presented in the text, adding a few more concrete details and making it a little more vivid, but going through the thing the way the counselor went through it as the case was set forth in the book. And, of course, our first point in the problem section of the book on page 19 is that the counselor has missed the boat. Now, I'm going to ask the group that's working here, they didn't know I was going to do this, but I'm going to ask them how this counselor missed the boat. Can you give us some idea about how the counselor missed the boat, any one of you four?
I think she could have tried to find out some more specifics in addressing the family situation. She certainly understood, as well as the parents did, that it was a mess. But there was no attempt to get down to the nitty-gritty, so to speak.
Excellent. She operated with very little information and gathered and gained very little more in this session.
Perhaps she also could have determined the basis of the marriage. In other words, what kind of relationship did the husband and wife have, which was probably causing part of the problems that the teenagers were having. So look at the husband-wife relationship before you get into the specifics of why the kids are misbehaving and so forth.
Okay, anything else? Yes.
I think she could have inquired a little bit more what the parents' role was in this competitiveness. Now, obviously, when there's five kids, they're going to vie for attention, which I think may have been part of it, but they may also have encouraged this by saying, Tom, why can't you study as hard as John does? He gets these great grades, and you're always, you know, this and that, and just to see if they've encouraged this and encouraged them to treat each child individually and encourage their own talents, not to be competitive against somebody else's talents, but to encourage what God has given them and only compete against himself to improve and not against the other person.
Good. You're pointing out again that she really didn't gather the data necessary to really know what was behind this problem and was guessing, more or less. In fact, she puts words into the counselee's mouth all the way through here without really digging in for what the facts of the situation are. And so there may have been other factors involved, as you're suggesting, which she doesn't even know for sure one way or the other, whether it's all just the kids or whether the parents are also involved in it or what's happening here. The key here, the first key here to unlock this case, is that the counselor operates with too few pieces of material. You can't put the whole picture together when most of the pieces of the puzzle are lost. Particularly when you don't even have some of the pieces that go around the border of that jigsaw puzzle, you know, and you only got a piece of blue and you know that sky, but boy, where is it? Right, left? Who knows? It may even be reflected sky in the pool in the bottom of the picture. So you're in trouble if you don't get a few more pieces and start with the corner pieces of the puzzle and then get that outside edge and then move in. Now, this counselor may say accurate things and may observe the things that are obvious, but the parents already knew a lot of the things that were obvious here, and so many of the observations that are made are really useless. They're accurate, but useless. The counselor simply repeats and sort of underscores and underlines some of the things that have been happening that are problems, but doesn't really give
useful solutions to problems. Obviously, there are no solutions if the data are missing, you see. So where there are inadequate data, then you feel the pressure to just go on and talk somehow or other in these abstract and non-helpful ways, because you can't really dig into anything and say, well, all right, if that's the problem, then here's what God says to do about it. You don't really know the problem, so you can't really bring the solutions to it. So there are not enough data. The second thing that's missing in this session is that the counselor settles for keeping a few things in mind, for some understanding, for some insight kinds of things, but really doesn't even give any hope. There's no hope given in this whole session. The counselor says, I can see why you get frustrated. Well, you know, that's great. They could see that before they came. And now the counselor sees it. Fine, the counselor is also involved in the problem in the same way that they are. But there's no biblical assurance that when two Christians put their hearts and souls to a problem God's way, that God blesses and brings answers. Even if she didn't have any more data, she could at least come forth with that kind of encouragement. And there is no assignment giving indicating that there is the possibility of change. Even the assignment to gather data is not given, you see. Well, we just don't know enough. Well, even if the counselor said, look, obviously this session we've heard a lot of description about what's going wrong, but we really don't know in specific terms about what's going wrong. We know that you're upset. We know the place is a mess. We know the place is wild. We know there's fighting going on, possibly competitiveness. We know that the thing is kind of a chaotic mess where you've tried to put two things together that haven't gone together. Now, we're going to have to unsort this scrambled kind of mess where all the monofilament is all mashed and twisted and wound together. We're going to have to get a hold of an end of it somewhere, and we're going to have to pull on that end, and we're going to have to unknot a few knots as we go along, but we're going to have to thread a course through all of this. You see, the counselor lets it all stay messy. The counselor doesn't get a hold of anything. The counselor doesn't start out with a theme or a thread and start pulling on that. The counselor needs to do so. So an assignment that would lead to that even would be helpful. If the counselor admitted that in this session, we just haven't got enough concrete data. All right, says the counselor, I'll give you a DPP form to keep this week. What I'd like you to do is to take this Discovering Problem Patterns form, which is virtually just a sort of a schedule of the week with a lot of blank pages, and I'd like you to keep a record of every time there's a fight this week. And I'd like you to record who fought about what. Obviously, this couple themselves aren't able to give, at this point, very adequate data. They're also messed up and so confused. They haven't done any kind of an analysis or a study of the situation. So I want you to keep an accurate record this week about who fought about what and what you did about it and what the results were. Now, if that kind of an assignment is given, you see, that gives some hope in and of itself. We're going to do something about it. We haven't begun to solve it, but we've begun to see what's actually happening. We've begun to confine the mess. We've begun to say, all right, we're going to see how many knots we've got in the monofilament before we start trying to unscramble something we don't even understand yet. We're going to understand it, really understand it, instead of saying, I hope this helps you understand it by saying there's probably a lot of competitiveness due to their close ages. Well, you know, that's a truism, but what does it say? And you might also give some kind of an assignment in terms of a code of conduct, at least the beginning essentials for a code of conduct in that home. What are going to be the rules in this new home? Do you agree upon the discipline? This is one of the areas where since fighting was going on and there was a wild household and all that sort of thing. Do you agree upon the discipline of the children, or are you for each other's throats about it? Now, obviously, there can be no kind of consistency when that takes place. There's nothing but confusion for the children. And incidentally, that's one of the areas of greatest confusion among families, the inconsistency of discipline. And now, let's think about that for just a moment as sort of a sideline here, but it's very vital to this kind of case. You see, suppose you were teaching a man from Mars or somebody who knew very little or nothing about baseball, teaching him how to play baseball.
You take him out to a field and you show him the diamond. And you show him each of the bases and show him the pitcher's mound and what kinds of equipment are used and run through the rules with him and maybe let him run the bases and swing a bat a couple of times, throw a few balls for him to hit, put a glove on his hand and let him catch a ball or six. And maybe you go through this for about a week or so and he's beginning to get the hang of it, beginning to understand what the game's all about. He's beginning to sort of catch on and maybe even get a little enthusiasm about it. But he's very poor at doing it, obviously, in 1 week. But he's beginning. But you see, you're not satisfied with a beginning. You want it all yesterday. So you say, oh, he'll never learn this. So you take him out the next Monday, and here he is ready to really dig in on this business of learning baseball, learning the skills of it and how to play it. And he's getting a little enthusiasm about it now that he's beginning to catch on. And sure enough, he gets out there, and here is an entirely different field laid out. He had a diamond before. Now there's a circle with another circle outside of it and a pitcher's mound in the middle, which has a contraption like a lazy Susan sitting on it. And here are bases all around the inner circle. And here are batters standing at each one of these 16 bases around the inner circle and fielders with gloves standing around the outer circle. And now you're going to teach him the rules for an entirely new kind of ball game. You're going to teach him circular baseball. Well, you begin to explain all these different and new rules and you've laid out a new field and all this sort of thing and he learns how to play, but he's less enthusiastic this time because he gets the rules from the first thing mixed up with the rules from the second game and he was just starting to learn that one and now he's got to relearn a whole new game. It's just all a new ball game and he's not all that enthusiastic about it, but he goes through it for about a week and learns a little bit, but not quite as much as he learned the first time. But now the third week he goes out and says, okay, I'm going to really learn that circular baseball. But sure enough, he gets out there and there's a 5-point start. Well, if you keep erasing all the lines that you've drawn in discipline and continue to put in new lines all the time, before the old rules are learned and people begin to develop the new patterns, and incidentally it takes about 3 weeks of doing something regularly to begin even to conform to a new pattern, and it takes about 3 more weeks after it starts to become comfortable for it to settle in as a settled pattern of life. And very, very few parents go 3 weeks, let alone 6, in any discipline. They want answers yesterday. They'll tell you when you say, all right, here is what God says to do. You're to discipline your children. Why don't you do X, Y, Z? They say, well, I tried that, and it didn't work. Well, now, when anybody tells you that they tried something God said and it didn't work, you know right away that there's something wrong. Either you are wrong in saying that this is what God said, and you might be, and you need to examine that first, or they are wrong in telling you they really tried it. So you want to investigate by question asking again, what specifically did you do, or how many times did you do it? And that's the question that usually rings the bell at this point. You say, how often, how long did you do this? Oh, I did it for 3 days, and I didn't get any results. Well, you see, there's the problem. If you're always rubbing out the line, starting a new rule, not staying with it, that becomes very discouraging. This fellow who has the new rules for baseball, each time he comes out in a new week, finally says, I'll just forget the whole business. I'm just thoroughly disgusted with it all. And you know, that's how kids react in those very contemporary passages in Ephesians 6:4, and in the parallel passage in Colossians 3, where it says, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. Or in Colossians, the parallel passage where it says, do not discourage them that they will lose heart. And you put the two of those together, those parallel passages, and you've got exactly the spirit that so many children... Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. Or in Colossians, the parallel passage where it says, do not discourage them that they will lose heart. And you put the two of those together, those parallel passages, and you've got exactly the spirit that so many children today have. They have given up on discipline because they say, ah, what's the use? They're angry, and they're angry because they've lost all the enthusiasm for even trying. And that's what causes it. You see, there are many other causes, but this is one of the crucial causes of it. So, you want to investigate that kind of thing when you find fighting and chaos in a wild household. Here are probably two people who had two entirely different backgrounds. If there was any discipline in these backgrounds for the children, they didn't think about conforming
the old ways to one third new and different way to either one, and informing the children that there was going to be this change and that both of them were agreed upon it. So you're going to help them to work out a new code of conduct for that home that is true to the Word of God, fair to the children, and is consistently kept. You want to find out what their practices are. Ask them to write them down. Ask them to work on what they're going to do. You're also going to probably work out some conferences with this family, because there are probably some problems between the two of them as well in this situation. I would want, in order to gather data in this session, to jump on certain phrases. For example, when Vic says, right, putting together two messed up lives like ours, and then goes on to say, makes for a wild household. I'd want to zero in on those two phrases. I'd want to unpack them. I'd want to say, now, let's examine that. You say your lives are messed up. Let's dig in to see what the mess looks like. Tell me how they're messed up. You see, very often problems in a second marriage grow out of wrongly concluded first marriages. People enter into second marriages with all sorts of raw, bleeding things that have never been healed, never had a clean break with the past, never been dealt with biblically, and then they try to put together some new thing out of that kind of a past that doesn't make a very good marriage. You can't build for the future on the rubble of the past. The past must be cleared and dealt with before you can move on to the future. You've got to have a clear building site, a clean start, a fresh start with a clean break to the past. Maybe they shouldn't have even been married on the basis of what they had or had not done with the past, and maybe they've got some past to put into the past before they can really deal with this future. All that may be irritating them. It's okay to acknowledge the greatness of their difficulty. That is right. You don't ever minimize. But it is not right not to emphasize the greater power of Jesus Christ in overcoming the difficulties. Now, I think that many things could be said about this situation. Are the parents making it, or is it only the children's conflict? I think that's a very vital issue to settle. And so, you want to unpack the negative evaluations, gather data, suggest biblical solutions, give encouragement and hope, give appropriate homework that grows out of something that you've gathered in this solution, or at least some homework geared to gather more data for the future, like the discovering problem patterns package or the code of conduct assignment to start drawing up the rules for this new household. And, of course, you might, at some point, bring in some of the children. The counselor can keep this in mind. Some of these older children in particular who are having problems might be brought in individually or together to see what can be done to encourage them to work on this problem that they now have. So the counselor ought to be careful then about interpreting, putting words in one's mouth, not controlling a situation, letting people make abstractions, instead of being concrete and dealing by terms of hope and help from God's Word with the vital issues involved. And on this matter of marriage problems, divorces and remarriages, let me just say one final word. We are not going to have less of those problems in the future, but more. It used to be that those problems were only outside of the church. They are growingly a problem that we face from within the context of God's people. There's a lot of failure in preventive work going on in the area of marriage, or this would not be happening. It would not be happening even with the erosion of values all around us on such a large scale if we were doing the job as Christians, really instructing one another in how to put marriages together the right way. Marriage counseling ought to begin in the cradle role. Every teacher in a Sunday school ought to be dealing with marriage counseling and know that he or she is doing so. The materials that are used, if they don't do it, ought to be interpreted in such a way that they do it. Speaking about, look at this daddy and this mommy here in this picture. What would they do if they had an argument? How would they handle that kind of argument? Beginning at the very earliest stages to start to talk about things. They would go to the Bible to find the answer instead of saying what I think is right or what I think is right. It's like two people fighting over a telephone number. One says, I think it's 657-1289. The other one says, no, it's 657-1288. Well, which is right? 89, 88, 89, 88. How do you know it's that? I think so, and I'm right. Well, I think the other, and I'm right. That's the way most people argue. Not over telephone numbers only, but over many issues. How do you settle an argument like that? You go to the authority. You open the telephone book. And sure enough, it's 657-1283. As it usually winds up. So, what you've got is an authority to turn to. A final standard. And you can use an illustration like that at an age where children can understand it. Where they're beginning to use a telephone directory and a telephone themselves to call their friends across the street. And this is exciting stuff for them. You can show them how two people who have an argument, a brother and a sister, a mommy and a daddy who have an argument, have a book that God gave them to settle all those kinds of arguments. Shall we do this or shall we not do this? Yes, we may do it because the Bible says we can do it. No, we may not do it because God has said in the Bible, we do not do this. The Bible is our standard. It's a thing that keeps peace in a home between a husband and wife. It settles questions. It's a thing that keeps peace between brothers and sisters. It is our standard for the home. And you begin to get children at an early age to think in terms of the Bible and God's solutions to problems in the home. Another problem that has to do with this matter of discipline, I might just say in passing, is that we have tried too hard to discipline in some cases, and thereby under-disciplined. We have made too many rules. When you make 65 rules, you either fail to enforce those rules, except when they irritate, the infraction of them irritates you enough that you fail to enforce them, or you become a warden instead of a parent, doing nothing but searching down infractions so that you can pounce on the violators of the code. God only gave us 10 rules for all of life. Some parents have more rules for the nursery. It's important for us to realize that we should never make any rule that we are incapable of enforcing, and not too many rules. If you can get 2 rules enforced over the next 6 weeks or so, and you really indicate that every time that this rule is violated, you will punish it with a clearly spelled out punishment ahead of time, people will get the idea in that home that you mean business. But if you have 20 rules, which you can't in any way police, and you only respond to infractions now and then when they get on your nerves, you have taught that I don't mean business when I lay down a rule. Better to work on 2 for 6 weeks, 2 more for the next 6 weeks, and 2 more the weeks after that. You'll make haste slowly. There are many things about this question of child discipline. Many things about the question of second marriages and problems of divorce. We haven't time to go into all of these here. But as we go along in various publications and so on, we'll be dealing with those problems in more depth. One of the crucial issues is church discipline in cases of marriage. I would simply refer you at this point to the chapter in the Christian Counselor's Manual that deals with the reconciliation discipline dynamic and the section of that that has to do with divorce and remarriage in the relationship of church discipline to that. That is a beginning in this area. Much more needs to be done. But it also refers you to some other books which I think are vital on this question. It's time now for you to develop 4 or 5 other cases from your counseling experience. Turn these into case studies similar to those that you have heard on these tapes and have read in the Christian Counselor's Casebook. And then have your group role play and discuss them, just as we have on these tapes.